You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Werewolves aren't anything new. Legends of half-men, half-canine beasts can be traced back thousands of years, but they've been making quite a comeback of late, showing up in both hit TV shows and popular young adult fiction. British author Glenn Duncan's imagining of the creatures, though, isn't for the kids. In his latest book, The Last Werewolf, the once great species is on the brink of extermination, and his protagonist, the last of his kind, runs from the men and vampires who are hunting him in a gory, sex-filled chase. The novel, which has already been optioned for the movies, is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome Glenn Duncan to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
This is your eighth novel.
Correct.
Your first on a werewolf?
Yes.
Why is Jake Marlowe the last werewolf on Earth? What happened to all the others?
Well, it's a complicated story. Jake is the last because for a couple of hundred years at least, nobody has been surviving the werewolf bite, which is the method by which a regular human being becomes a werewolf.
Which is the method that he became a werewolf.
Exactly. He was turned in 1842. And as far as he knows, there haven't been any more werewolves made since him.
Well, is there any other way to make a werewolf? Can werewolves mate?
Well, that's kind of the $64,000 question in my book, and I don't really want to answer it very specifically because I might give away a plot point that would be spoiling the fun for readers. But it's an open question, let's say, at this point.
Well, is he determined to keep the species alive?
No, on the contrary. When the novel opens, he is very much at the end of his tether. He's been alive for 200, and he's rapidly approaching his 201st birthday. And as you might imagine, despite spending a lot of time and money sucking the marrow out of life, there comes a point where enough is enough. Existential ennui has overtaken him, and he's ready to meet the end.
But he would live forever if he doesn't do something to change that?
Not in my book. Werewolf lifespan is 400 years. And if you're going to ask me, how do I know that? The answer is, I don't. I just made it up.
But you did have to do a lot of research.
None whatsoever.
You just simply based it on what you know from the popular culture?
Exactly right. I grew up watching great horror movies in the 60s and 70s and a few in the 80s even. So that was, you know, just a case of consulting my own imagination.
Well, he, Jake, spends years researching the origins of his species.
Well, there is rumored to be this document in the form of a journal kept by an archaeologist who, in the 19th century, was working on a dig in the Middle East and encounters a guy who claims to know the origin of werewolves. And he writes this account down in his journal. But the journal itself is lost and has become something of a mythical or apocryphal object.
Well, I'm sure you thought about why we have had so many myths of half-man, half-animal creatures. There were the centaurs, the mermaids, the minotaur. The Greeks particularly loved them. Do you have any idea why?
It just seems to be part of the human imaginative grammar, that we are interested in transformation, we are interested in hybridity, we are interested in things that fall between distinct categories. I don't know what the answer is, except to say that as literature, you know, even the oldest stories on the planet indicate this abiding fascination with sort of fantastical creatures or transformation.
And Zeus punished a man by turning him into a wolf in Ovid's Metamorphosis, but I don't know if he was a werewolf.
Well, that's often cited as one of the root stories for lycanthropy. It's where the word lycanthropy comes from. It's an ambiguous story. There are different versions of it for one thing and for another. I mean, there are other root sources for the werewolf myth. What's interesting about the werewolf myth is that it's common cross culturally. I mean, most, you know, there are very many cultures in which this idea of men turning into wolves or people turning into wolves features.
Because some people think it is a result of hypertrichosis, a condition that causes an abnormal amount of hair growth all over the body and face. And so you see that. You don't know about that?
I don't know anything about that. I could do with a dose of it myself, given that
I'm losing my hair
by the minute.
I have to shave my forehead and everything every day. But it's in fact, it's referred to as werewolf syndrome.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, you've told me something I didn't know.
Your werewolves and vampires are still people, or at least they were at one point. Do they feel any human guilt when they do things like murder?
Yes. I mean, my starting point for the book was really to try and imagine what it would be like to be a werewolf, rather than starting with the conventions and saying, well, what is it that we know werewolves do? But just to actually take the psychology of the condition seriously. So, you know, yes, you remain in all other respects yourself, including having a conscience and a sense of right and wrong. But you are, by virtue of this condition, forced to kill and eat somebody once a month to stay alive. So the question was, what does that do to you as a human being?
This kind of writing can take a couple of different tracks. There are people who just want to be part of the old tradition, and then there are others who want to use these traditions to make some other kind of point. And I suspect you're in the second group. A metaphor, a werewolf becomes a metaphor for something else.
Well, I suppose I'm in the second group, but only accidentally. And when I started work on The Last Werewolf, the intention was to write a straight genre thriller. No philosophy, no existential angst, no moral inquiry, no metafictional conceits, none of that.
What happened along the way?
Well, what happened, not so much along the way, but almost immediately, I mean, within sort of, you know, the first few pages of having this protagonist up and running, was that it became apparent that it was a perfect vehicle for writing about the things that I've always been interested in, which are, you know, love and sex and death and morality and, you know, the curse of cruelty and this knack we've got for occasional compassion. That conflict between those sort of warring desires and warring aspects of the human psyche has always been what I've been interested in. And I think the problem is that no matter what I set out to write about, that is what I end up writing about, even if on the face of it, it's a werewolf.
So you wind up, I don't know if this is true of other people's werewolves, but the sex drive increases when one becomes a werewolf.
Yes. I suspect that in the case of Jake Marlowe, he would have had a pretty healthy sex drive even without the curse. But yes, given that the werewolf is this, you know, locus for the notion of the lower appetites or the visceral or the beastly, it seemed appropriate that he would be, you know, rampant.
Are there equal numbers of male and female werewolves?
No. For some unexplained reason, rates of infection for females have always been mysteriously low. So, you know, in the world of The Last Werewolf, there are perhaps there's one female per 1,000 males. So competition is fierce.
But in this case, Jake is pretty much alone now.
Yes.
Would he have recognized other werewolves in the past when there were more?
Yes, he would. But they are not social animals, unlike their canine relatives. They're not, at least
in
my
packs.
World, you know, they're not pack animals.
The Last Werewolf has a soundtrack recorded by the British band The Real Tuesday Weld. We can get into Tuesday Weld and her significance later. But what does that mean exactly? Are we supposed to listen to the music while we're reading the book?
Well, the soundtrack to the book came about as a result of my long friendship with Stephen Coates, who is the driving force behind the band The Real Tuesday Weld. We grew up together. We've known each other for about 30 years. And one night in the pub, drunkenly, we came up with the idea of having a soundtrack to a book. This was,
that was the previous one.
It was an earlier novel of mine, yeah, I, Lucifer. And initially it was just a bit of fun that we did to amuse ourselves. And the idea is really that these are standalone objects. You don't need the book to get the record. You don't need the record to get the book. But for readers and listeners who discover the connection, it's a little added, fun. The Last Werewolf seemed an appropriate novel to do that with.
You have stuck to some of the old traditions. He has a weakness to silver, transforms under a full moon. You could have invented your own monster, couldn't you?
I could, but if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
So the book now has been optioned for a film. This is going to be obviously not a PG-13.
I would have a hard time imagining how they could make this a PG-13. You'd have to cut out quite a lot of material.
Pop culture has gotten crowded recently with the supernatural stories. So vampires have made a major comeback, although often within a religious context. We have now your werewolf. Why do you think this is? Why do you think people are attracted to these kinds of stories?
As I say, I think they always have been. As you mentioned earlier, the founding myths in Western literature are often to do with metamorphosis, fantastical creatures. I think part of it, I suppose, is that when we come to examine notions of good and evil, I mean, if we're still using that kind of language, what people like to do is to sort of carve evil off and put it somewhere safe. So I think one of the roles that these creatures serve is as a repository for our notions of evil. You know, we don't want to think that evil is a human phenomenon. So we have a kind of mythological repository for it in the form of these creatures. But you know, all the monster stories in the world will work best if they're really ultimately about human beings.
You mentioned that you originally wanted to write a genre novel, mm-hmm. wound up with a literary novel.
If you say so.
I'm sure that. Well, I think most people reading it will recognize that you worry about style and
sure.
You do go into all sorts of areas that we don't normally find in this kind of genre. That was just by accident?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it was just that I had a protagonist. The great appeal was having a protagonist who'd been around a lot, you know, so had things to say about his journey through the last 200 years. And I just, the irony of having a werewolf who was also fanatical about books was just a little too enticing to resist. So,
your final paragraph suggests that there might be more of the story to tell. Should I assume you're working on a sequel?
Yeah, you should assume that.
Meanwhile, we have the first one in the series, perhaps, called The Last Werewolf. It is published by Knopf. My great thanks to Glenn Duncan, who's come by to talk about this, his eighth novel.
Thank you.